Smoking Tobacco Historic District in downtown Durham, this is Due South on WUNC. I'm Leonita Inge. It's Friday, time for the North Carolina News Roundup. On today's panel, Rusty Jacobs, voting and election integrity reporter at WUNC, Monica Casey, Durham reporter for WRAL, Ben Tobin, Greater Triangle reporter for the Triangle Business Journal, and Brianna Atkinson, WUNC's higher education reporter and UNC Fletcher Fellow. We're gearing up for a busy week in Raleigh. Lawmakers are due back in town for the short session, and a lot is on the table. But first, here are some voices that made the news this week.
I will now entertain a motion to repeal and replace
with no debate or discussion. The Committee on University Governance,
the Board's University Governance Committee, voted Wednesday on a policy that would eliminate DEI offices and other efforts. The vote came after no discussion and took less than 4 minutes.
North Carolina's top elections official addressed lawmakers this week on some of the big changes voters saw in this year's primaries.
News from the mayor of Raleigh, Marianne Baldwin, announcing she will not run for re-election, saying she's putting her health and family first.
In just 3 weeks in March, North Carolinians wagered $659 million on sports.
North Carolina A&T State University's cheer team making history for the school and historically black colleges and universities.
Home ice, Carolina Hurricanes, New York Islanders, first round, be there or be square.
Oh my goodness, I'm going to be square. I don't think I'm going to make it, but I'm definitely a Hurricanes fan. So a lot to be discussed this hour, so let's get to it. Another member of President Joe Biden's administration is in North Carolina this week. Today, U.S. Energy Secretary Jennifer Granholm is in Raleigh. She's expected to give a speech on clean energy industrial policy. The Energy Office is partially funding projects in 20 states. I'm assuming North Carolina is one of those states. And these are the projects to help cut carbon dioxide emissions in heavy manufacturing like cement and chemicals and steel. Part of Granholm's speech is expected to highlight high quality, good paying jobs. We hear that all the time, don't we? Yeah, we want all the jobs to be high paying. Well, Ben Tobin is the Greater Triangle reporter for the Triangle Business Journal. He's here with me in the studio, and he's been reporting on a big job story, Amazon. It can't get bigger than Amazon, can it? You know, Amazon is right on schedule, believe it or not, and has opened a huge facility in Johnston County, promising more than 1,000 jobs. So how's everything going in Smithfield?
People are buzzing in Smithfield right now. This project was announced 3 years ago, and there were various times that people were kind of wondering what's going on with this plot of land. You know, they were working on upfitting the 620,000 square foot facility, and at the time in 2021, promised that it would be 500 jobs. So now, come along 3 years later, the Amazon kind of quietly opens this facility, to my surprise. Usually I thought it would be some big announcement. There is going to be a ribbon cutting next week. But in February, late February, they opened it, you know, following through on this promise of a $100 million investment, and now saying that they're going to create more than 1,000 jobs in the facility, which is huge for Smithfield. Smithfield has had, you know, over the past 12 years, maybe a little more than 1,000 people moved there.
I was about to say, what is the population of Smithfield? This is going to totally change the landscape there.
Yeah, I believe per census numbers, latest census numbers in 2022, it was around a little over 12,000.
Mm-hmm.
But right now, you know, Smithfield's changing. The whole Johnston County's changing, but usually a lot of that development has gone on in Clayton to the west, and it's starting to spill out further east. So the mayor was telling me the other day, Mayor Andy Moore, that there are 2,000 housing units either in the planning stages or in construction. There's more to come. I'm looking at this huge mixed-use neighborhood that could bring 830 more housing units, you know, mixed between apartments and townhomes and single-family homes. So Amazon, though, is really kind of both symbolic of the change that Smithfield's going through, but a potential catalyst for future change as well.
Definitely. I know they hope for future change because, I mean, actually, the census numbers were quite stagnant in that particular part of Johnston County. You know, Smithfield was not growing at all for the longest. Now, since we know the mayor's, everybody's happy, you know, they're going to have this big ribbon cutting next week. But these jobs really aren't paying a lot of money. You know, it's like $17 an hour. So I wonder, what will these workers be doing there?
Yeah, so it's an import facility, or commonly known as cross-dock. It's a little bit different from a typical Amazon warehouse. Usually that's more of a distribution facility where people are you know, sorting through packages and getting them ready to go for delivery. This is where manufacturers start and bring their products in the first place. So this is kind of one of the first steps of the supply chain. So workers there will be kind of taking in these packages and making sure they're ready to go for the next step, which is more of those distribution centers.
And those folks probably get paid a little bit more, you think?
Maybe. I'm not quite sure off the top of my head. I know, you know, Amazon is a little bit ahead compared to some other retailers like a Walmart or a Target when it comes to that minimum wage, but certainly compared to, and with the cost of living, it's
right, because that's like why they're in Johnston County and not in Durham County, for example.
$17 an hour goes a lot further in Smithfield than it would where we are, you know, here in American Tobacco right now.
I know. So now let's move to Chatham County, where it seems like manufacturing is slowing down a little bit at the Vietnamese electric vehicle automaker VinFast. Is there a reason to worry about that?
You know, there's the VinFast, when they announced this huge job that, of course, we all know about, this huge job promise of 7,500 jobs, a $4 billion investment back in 2022, had a really aggressive timeline. And people knew it at the time, saying that they would get cars up and running off the lots by the end of 2024. They've since kind of gone back on that and said it would be by the end of 2025. But even now, there's just been very, very little construction done. There was their whole groundbreaking celebratory ceremony back in July. But the News and Observer, you know, to give credit to them and my friend Brian Gordon there, had this wonderful, you know, story using drone photography to show that really not that much has changed since, and that it might actually be...
No dirt has turned.
Yeah.
You know, I was at the announcement for VinFast a couple of years ago in downtown Raleigh. State leaders from the House of Representatives, Robert Reeves, Chatham County.
It was the biggest jobs announcement in history.
And they had two gleaming cars out there for display. And I thought this was great. And you know, the arrival of an automaker was a big coup. I mean, this is something that North Carolina has been after for a long time. You've been here a long time, always getting close, never quite making it. VinFast was the one, and there was a lot of euphoria. But I think, as Ben has said, and the reporting has shown, is that having an announcement is one thing. Getting the automaker up and running is a big deal, especially with electric vehicles.
That's right, Rusty. And, you know, the state promised a lot to VinFast. You know, they were giving them the kitchen sink, everything to make sure that they built in North Carolina. So we have to keep abreast of that situation because I hear VinFast isn't making a lot of cars anywhere just yet.
Yeah, you know, this past quarter, they just had their quarterly earnings report. Distributed a little less than 10,000 cars, which is a 28% drop off from the quarter before.
Not
a great sign. And they're looking to distribute over, you know, I think the number is 100,000 vehicles by the end of the year. So, you know, under 10,000 is definitely short of that promise. But one thing I want to emphasize, too, is this is a big deal for Chatham County. And if this doesn't go through, there's a lot of people who have promised jobs, hopes and dreams of certain developments that might be able to come up around there. That, you know, that VinFast is kind of the linchpin, the really important part to put it all together. And without VinFast, who knows what the future of this area of Chatham County looks like.
Well, thanks, Ben. Just like the governor said, that was the largest jobs announcement in the history of the state. 7,500 jobs at one time, I guess over time, but a big promise. Again, thank you. Well, Governor Roy Cooper, right now, he's hot, not happy. With news this week from the UNC Board of Governors, he released a statement saying, quote, "Our diversity should be used to highlight our state strengths, not our political divisions." So that brings me to Brianna Atkinson. She's WUNC's higher education reporter and has been following the news this week from the UNC Board of Governors. A committee voted unanimously to really just get rid of diversity, equity, and inclusion offices and officers on all the system's 17 campuses. Brianna, this news is kind of like spread like wildfire. It just won't stop. So please tell me about the committee that proposed this and why.
Yeah, absolutely. It was the UNC Board of Governors University Governance Committee. And what they did was called a repeal and replace. So that policy that you were referring to, it's been in place since 2019, mandated diversity, equity, and inclusion offices on all 17 campuses. That's all 16 public universities in North Carolina and the North Carolina School for Science and Mathematics. And it also mandated like a UNC system DEI liaison, institutional DEI chief diversity officers. They replaced it with a new policy, and it has a focus on something called institutional neutrality. And there's a specific provision in that policy that says chancellors have to certify to UNC System President Peter Hans that they have removed force and spending for DEI programs and that they also change job titles and positions by September 1st of this year.
Wow, is that a lot of jobs we're talking about?
It's quite a lot. There are, like I said, 17 campuses. Some of them have very robust DEI offices. They have a chief diversity officer, their support staff, their staff for individual communities. So women, LGBTQ students, African-American students, Asian-American, Hispanic, Indigenous students, like a lot of different communities have representatives in DEI offices.
Well, you know, we're going to come back to that topic after the break. We'll continue our conversation with Brianna Atkinson, Ben Tobin, Monica Casey, and Rusty Jacobs. And later this hour, we'll learn more about North Carolina's first marijuana dispensary. It's opening this weekend in Cherokee.
The Eastern Band, during their tribal government elections in 2021, approved medical cannabis, and that established a cannabis control board as well. And they actually have a farm where they're growing marijuana on the Quala boundary.
You're listening to Due South. We're back on Due South with the North Carolina News Roundup. I'm Leonita Inge. On Saturday, April 20th, tomorrow, the Eastern Band of Cherokee Indians will open North Carolina's first marijuana dispensary.
It's unique, even in a unique landscape. At this point, there's more than 20 states that have legalized recreational marijuana. So new things are kind of few and far between in this policy space, as someone who's covered this now for 6 years. And what the Cherokee are doing is actually new and unique.
That's Natalie Fertig, federal cannabis policy reporter for Politico. We'll have more from Natalie and Blue Ridge Public Radio's Lily Knapp later in the hour. But with me in the studio is another group of great journalists, Rusty Jacobs, voting and election integrity reporter for WUNC, Monica Casey, Durham reporter for WRAL, Ben Tobin, Greater Triangle reporter, the Triangle Business Journal, and Brianna Atkinson, UNC's higher education reporter and UNC Fletcher Fellow. I'd like to continue our conversation, Brianna. And Monica, you've both been covering this, I consider it a big story, on diversity, equity, and inclusion at UNC. And it looks like efforts to close offices and remove officers in the DEI offices across the 17 campus system. You know, in many ways, I guess this really should not be a big surprise, right? Because the UNC system has already pushed to eliminate the use of, I hear, diversity statements in hiring and admissions. So little by little, a move is being made to, I don't know, sort of just eliminate DEI offices, not just in the North Carolina system, because I actually heard this happening all over the country. So I wonder, what's that all about? Is this like this trend?
Yeah, there's other states. The Chronicle of Higher Education, they actually have a tracker, of a DEI tracker of like legislation that's being passed. And there's about, I feel, 84 bills that are going on right now that states across the U.S. are trying to pass against DEI initiatives and efforts. North Carolina is green on their map because of that one policy that you were just talking about with hiring. And Florida, Alabama, Texas, like a lot of them are making moves against DEI legislation. So it seems to be like a national trend against it.
I know. Monica, since we, like I said, how this is probably spread like wildfire, talk about this, but it seems like, I guess the UNC system is trying to put out some of these fires now. You know, no one's really talking to reporters one-on-one about it or even in groups, but I guess they're putting out statements. You think they're trying to backtrack a little?
I think they are trying to keep as many people happy as possible. We got a hint this might be coming from a UNC Chapel Hill trustee who said they would might be looking at DEI and the future of it. I think it is likely a done deal that it's going to be gone. The Board of Governors as a whole will still have to vote on it next month, but it's probably going to be on their consent agenda, and we know what happens with consent agendas. One thing I've noticed is that students, particularly undergraduates, even though they're only there for 4 years, they're really paying attention to this. I was on campus in Chapel Hill specifically on Wednesday when this was happening. Was it Tuesday?
It's been going on.
It's blurring.
Yes, it is blurring. And not only that, I hear students are even signing petitions. I mean, hundreds and hundreds of people have signed a petition against this move.
They are. And we were just pulling students over by the old well, asking if they'd heard about it, what their thoughts were. And they are upset. They know what's going on and they're speaking out against it.
So, Brianna, do you know what's next? I guess the UNC Board of Governors will vote on this issue soon.
Yeah, they are set to meet as a full board again May 23rd. The Board of Governors, they haven't said anything about this. They have had no public discussion. They've met twice. UNC System President Peter Hans, after every full board meeting, he holds like a press conference with the media professionals that are there. I was there yesterday. They are not going on the record with anything. Like Monica said, him and BOG Chair Randy Ramsey, they released two statements about the policy. So kind of like Monica was saying, I expect too for it to fully pass and for it to pass through the consent agenda. I don't expect to see any discussion at all from them, which is incredibly unusual for their meetings.
Well, we'll be definitely following that. It definitely seems like a lot of politics at play, and a lot of these decisions definitely made down party lines. So we will keep up with that. You know, it's hard to forget it's election season with all the national political candidates and their surrogates coming to town. You know, former President Donald Trump is taking a break from his trial and will be headlining a rally in Wilmington tomorrow. But right now, there is a push just to make sure everything runs smoothly in November. And so Rusty Jacobs, WUNC's election integrity reporter, a legislative elections oversight committee hearing took place this week. The head of the State Board of Elections said that there was an alarming personnel trend underway. So I'd like you to talk a little bit about that. Why are so many county elections officials leaving?
Some of it due to retirement. I mean, people have served their 30 years in this kind of position, and it's time to go. Karen Brinson Bell, the executive director of the State Board of Elections, was before this oversight committee, and it was really a chance for her to talk about some of the numbers in terms of turnout, absentee by mail voting, photo ID getting its first big test since being reinstated by the state Supreme Court last year. We can talk about that. But she also took the opportunity to tell lawmakers that since 2019, there have been 60 changes in director positions at the county level. 100 counties each has their own county elections director. And she said, while some have been due to retirement, she has heard anecdotally from a lot of people who are departing that they are just worn out. They've been enduring harassment, a lot of hostility, a lot of mistrust about the administration of elections.
Yes.
And so she's saying these counties will need help. 28 directors this year will be handling their first presidential election year going into the general election. So going back a couple of years, the elections board at the state level had what they call 8 field supporter positions, and they were covered mostly by federal funds. They're not there now. Karen Brinson Bell said she will be coming back, as you noted, this short session about to start. And while they're just tweaking an already existing budget, she will be asking lawmakers to get back to that full 8 field supporters, because those state positions, they go out into the field on election years like this and help out at the county level where there's a problem with being understaffed.
You know, so over five years, I guess the pandemic happened during that time as well. It just sounds like people are just calling it quits. It almost seems like school teachers, you know, anybody that's working, I guess, closely with people and have these really these servant type positions that they probably loved, it's just harder to do. So is the job, it sounds like the job is getting harder, but we do know there, like you say, there've been some hostility in some of these places.
Yeah. And listen, some of it is partisan. Some of it derives from just a mistrust of the system that's also rooted in either mis or disinformation about, you know, about data. Constant requests, flood of requests for numbers and data that the people asking for that information believe will uncover some kind of malfeasance. It's not there. I mean, historically, elections run very smoothly. There's not a persistent issue of widespread fraud. Nonetheless, these requests and these campaigns persist. And so some people are getting worn out. But look,
money fix this? I mean, they need more people in the offices to help everything run smoother.
They need more money, and they need to see over time how things actually play out. I just want to point out some of the numbers that Karen Brinson-Bell talked about. 99.4% of the voters that turned out for the primaries showed up with a valid ID. So that's an indicator that people are adapting to this new, fairly new requirement to show a photo ID. But she also pointed out to the lawmakers, because a lot of the Republican lawmakers who were behind the photo ID requirement legislation were hailing this indicator. She said, now hold on, 24% of North Carolina's 7.4 million voters turned out. It's a very low turnout. And she said the people that do turn out for primaries are typically more civically engaged. They're more motivated. They're more up on information. You've got a much broader electorate turning out for the general election, many of whom might not be as prepared.
November can be crazy. It may be just wild. You know, you may not have enough workers and people who are trying out the new laws for the first time.
Possibly. But the point is, get the information out there. She said, that is, Karen Brinson-Bell said, that some of the advertising dollars for getting public service announcements and public information and education about voter ID out, some of that money was held in reserve. So they're prepared to really get the message out there. And people have to understand that if you go to the state board website, the information is there. And there are a lot of provisions within the photo ID law that enable even people without valid ID to still cast a ballot.
Well, thank you, Rusty, for that update. And we keep forgetting it's an election year. I mean, every now and then we're reminded.
Who's forgetting?
You're not forgetting, but I forget, you know. I don't see as many signs out, for example, you know. You know, I think I got one flyer in my door in a month, you know, these days. So I guess things will pick up, but thank you very much for that update. You know, I've always heard that when the weather starts to heat up, so does crime. And Monica Casey, she's the dorm reporter for WRAL. You know, you've been quite busy these days. As a matter of fact, you were near our offices yesterday at American Tobacco when there was a reported shooting. What happened? And I'm also told there was a shooting last week at American Tobacco.
That's right. So this is two in 1 week near this campus, which is unusual for this area. And we can say that with confidence looking at the crime.
Is that because the mayor lives right here?
He does live right here, and he was not happy about this. And what happened yesterday, there was a report of shots fired. Witnesses saw two people shooting at each other near the parking garage over near Jackie Robinson. And they fled, and that was around 10 in the morning. So the campus issued an alert, and then there was an unfounded 911 call claiming there was an active shooter closer to 11 o'clock. It sounds like there was maybe some miscommunication between some different groups, but that spurred an enormous police response. I was over in the courthouse, which is near this area, and I counted 7 fire trucks over by DPAC. It was an incredible response. Luckily, that second call was unfounded. The two suspects were already well off the scene. The students who had to evacuate from the high school in this area were able to go back to class and finish the rest of their day. So it was certainly a disruption and a scary one, but no one was hurt yesterday. In the case of the shooting last Thursday, it was exactly a week before this one yesterday, It was around 6 in the evening, and a man was shot and over on West Pettigrew Street. So it's still near the American Tobacco campus, a little bit on the other side of it. And he fled to the bus stop, and he had minor injuries and is expected to be okay. Police know they're looking for a black Honda Accord in that case.
You know, what are police really saying about these shootings? And also, what is the mayor and the city of Durham saying? And I know there was a Durham's homicide status hearing not too long ago. So I'm hopefully you have some numbers. It seems like there are more shootings happening in Durham and in some surrounding counties.
It certainly seems that way. In terms of the homicide status hearing, which is a quarterly hearing in Durham County Court, there are just over 80 cases pending. They're not all first-degree murder. There are a couple involuntary manslaughter charges, for example, and some of those cases are years old, but that's a lot of cases to work through. What's interesting, it certainly feels as though this spring that crime is up, but the numbers show the shootings are actually down from last year and the year before. We have had a lot of high-profile shootings in high-traffic areas this year, which I think is contributing to a feeling of there's more crime right now. But the mayor, we mentioned he lives in the American Tobacco campus, and he was frustrated yesterday. He is asking city council to bring back ShotSpotter, which has been controversial.
Very controversial.
And
yes,
he was on the losing end of the vote against it, which included no votes from two of the new city council members who were not convinced of its effectiveness. It'll be interesting to see if that comes back up and if people say, let's bring it back. It's also important to note the police department asked the city to keep it, and they chose not to.
Well, we're going to have to come back to all these stories because it's not even summer yet. And we know that shooting numbers, crime, it rises during the summer months. And it's not a happy time at all. Well, thank you, Monica, for that update. You know, another story, though, I know that you've been following, and maybe everybody at this table has been following, those sports betting numbers in North Carolina. I mean, some numbers have just come out. Did any of you all place any bets? Oh, not even on NC State watching.
I'll admit to it. They gave out some of these free bets at the very beginning. So I placed like a future on the Carolina Hurricanes to win the Eastern Conference.
Well, you're going to get paid. Did they win? Did they not win? Oh, they're just at the beginning.
They're at the very beginning.
Okay, at the very beginning. Okay, yeah, we have our fingers crossed for you. But Monica, tell us, how much money has been spent so far? I mean, North Carolinians have placed a lot of bets, hundreds of millions of dollars.
These numbers were staggering because they were only for 3 weeks of March. $659 million bet, about $590 million won by North Carolinians. That's the good news. North Carolinians also lost about $66 million in betting.
Well, they had to know that was going to happen.
Oh, yeah.
You know, Leonida, you said you haven't been seeing a lot of political ads or hearing. I don't know what you, where you have been, but I'll tell you, one thing you must have been seeing, you must have been seeing advertisements for DraftKings
everywhere,
and for all these online betting.
I have been seeing
betting,
that, yes.
Especially during March Madness. And I wonder how much the numbers stack compared to the advertising dollars put in by these companies.
Because I wonder if the ads will continue at that rate now that the word is out. I guess the big winner is the state of North Carolina. I mean, they made, what, $12 million
yeah,
in tax
money.
Revenue. And I guess they say they'll use that money wisely. Some of it's supposed to be used for what?
They have strict parameters around it. Some will go to NCDHHS for gambling addiction programs. Some of it will go to youth sports and those programs, which is pretty neat. And then some of it will go to athletic departments at some of the smaller UNC state schools. I believe it's $300,000 per school. So for some of those athletic departments, that's a big chunk of change.
That is a big chunk of change. You know, this was definitely an amazing March Madness, and I'm sure, you know, folks took advantage of that. But before we wrap up, Brianna, you know, when I think of college sports especially, people love college basketball and football in North Carolina. But we have a little problem, I think. You know, there are several schools in the system at UNC that do not have chancellors. So maybe just an update. When is UNC Chapel Hill going to have a new chancellor? When is North Carolina Central University going to have a new chancellor? When is Winston-Salem State University going to have a new chancellor? It seems to be creeping along here.
Yeah, those are all really great questions. I attended the first like search committee meeting for the UNC Chapel Hill chancellor search, and they want to have a chancellor by the end of this year. So they want for UNC System President Peter Hans to, you know, confirm who's going to be the next chancellor of UNC Chapel Hill by the end of this year. The rest of the search committees, they have been going on for a little bit longer. I know Winston-Salem State is one that's been going on for the longest out of all the new searches that are occurring, and they haven't set any dates yet for when they want to guarantee a new chancellor.
Well, thank you very much. Well, here's something to cheer about. The cheerleaders at North Carolina A&T State University, aren't they waiting for a new chancellor as well?
Yes.
Yes. Well, the cheerleaders are at least there. They've brought home their first championship title. It's the National Cheerleaders Association and National Dance Alliance College National Championship. They brought home first place honors in the intermediate small co-ed Division I. Go Aggies.
That was North Carolina A&T State University.
Well, thanks again, our panel, for joining me today. WUNC's Rusty Jacobs, Monica Casey of WRAL, WUNC's Brianna Atkinson, and Ben Tobin of the Triangle Business Journal. Coming up, North Carolina's first marijuana dispensary opens in Cherokee. You're listening to Due South.
It's Friday. I'm in love.
Welcome back to Due South. I'm Leonita Inge. This Saturday, April 20th, North Carolina's first marijuana dispensary will open in Cherokee, on the land of the Eastern Band of Cherokee Indians in western North Carolina. Now, before anyone gets too excited about the prospect of recreational marijuana, this dispensary will be selling for medical use only, at least for now. We're going to talk about how the dispensary came to be and what may still be to come for marijuana growth and sales in our state, a state where selling marijuana is still illegal. Blue Ridge Public Radio senior regional reporter Lily Canep is with me to break this all down, and also joining me is Natalie Furtick, federal cannabis policy reporter at Politico. Welcome, Natalie and Lily.
Thanks for having me.
Well, Lily, if marijuana sales are not legal in North Carolina, please remind us how it can come to be that there is a dispensary opening legally on the Quala boundary, the land of the Eastern Band of Cherokee Indians.
Yeah, Leonardo, it's exactly like you said. It's because it's the land of the Eastern Band of Cherokee. So that they are a sovereign nation, the only federally recognized tribe in North Carolina. And so because they are a sovereign nation, they're able to make their own laws. And so they have legalized medical marijuana, and they are moving towards recreational marijuana as well.
And for those who are not familiar where this land is, maybe you can describe its location. And I guess they've had this designated tribal land for well over 100 years.
Yeah, the Quala boundary is in western North Carolina, where I'm based, and it is in Jackson County, Swain County, a little bit in Haywood County, really over 500 acres across in the region. And what's really interesting about the Eastern Band of Cherokee, you know, historically, is that when the Indian Removal Act was passed, they actually were able to buy back their land here where they have always been in western North Carolina. And so that's what the Quala boundary is that land that they have bought back and is federal trust land.
So really, who can actually access this cannabis, you know, starting Saturday in Cherokee?
Yeah, so, you know, the Eastern Band during their tribal government elections in 2021 approved medical cannabis, and that established a cannabis control board as well. And they actually have a farm where they're growing marijuana on the Quala boundary. And so they've set up this whole regulatory process to be able to approve medical cannabis cards. So North Carolina residents can apply for those cards if they have about, there's 18 health conditions that can make it possible for you to receive one of those cards. And those are the folks who are going to be able to purchase medical marijuana at this new dispensary that's opening on Saturday. The dispensary is actually also going to accept medical cannabis cards from any other states and any other tribes.
So you have to explain a little bit more. These cards, so these are people who will be permitted to buy from this dispensary medical marijuana. Was the cutoff 1,200 cards? Because I know back in March, about 1,200 cards had been issued, but I know a lot more people have put in their applications. Is that correct?
There isn't really a cutoff that's been designated. They had been just working through the applications. When I talked to the director of the Cannabis Control Board in March, they had already approved 1,200 cards. And I talked to him just the other day this week, and they've gotten about 3,000 applications total. So they're still going to be working through those. I think some folks might not get their medical cards approved by Saturday. They have actually a 30-day period where they can kind of work through those applications. You know, the director was saying they need to get the appropriate picture to put on this medical card and make sure that the documents from your doctor that are saying that you are approved to be a part of this, they have to get all that paperwork in order before they can approve those.
Yeah, it kind of sounds almost like a cannabis passport. I mean, everything has to be correct on there. You have to be, at least 21 years old. And I also like to know, I wonder, these 1,200 cards that have already been issued, are they, you said they're from all across the country. I wonder what percentage are actually from this state.
To apply for the cannabis card, the medical cards with the Eastern Band, you had to be a North Carolina resident.
Oh, okay. Okay, because I was wondering if there was going to be an influx of people from nearby states or across the country.
Yeah, I called a bunch of the hotels on the boundary just to see if there's going to be a lot of people coming. And I guess 4 out of the 5 hotels that, you know, answered me back said, oh, you know, it's just a regular Saturday, but it's spring here in the mountains. It's starting to get towards tourist season now. So we'll see. I'm excited to see what happens on Saturday. I'm going to be out there at the dispensary opening.
Well, Natalie Fertig, our federal cannabis policy reporter with Politico, you know, as someone who focuses on the national cannabis policy landscape, was this something on your radar? Did it surprise you, or were you just waiting for it?
You mean the dispensary?
Yes.
Actually, it's something that we've been following because it's unique, even in a unique landscape. At this point, there's more than 20 states that have legalized recreational marijuana. So new things are kind of few and far between in this policy space, as someone who's covered this now for 6 years. And what the Cherokee are doing is actually new and unique. There's been other tribes that have legalized cannabis before the state that they were in have legalized, most specifically the Flandreau Santee Sioux in South Dakota, but they waited until state law matched their tribal law before opening dispensaries and before allowing people to come in from off tribal land to come in and purchase from their dispensary. So what the Cherokee are doing is, in a small way, another one of these experiments that we've been seeing states, cities, and other tribes deal with for the last 30 years in marijuana policy in the United States. It's a big question mark what's going to happen.
So to be clear, are cannabis and marijuana used interchangeably, you know, when it comes to this particular topic? Because I hear medical marijuana, and then I hear cannabis, and then I hear dispensaries, and I just wonder how they all connect.
It's a really good question, and I think it's very, very confusing to most Americans. You kind of have to think of cannabis and marijuana like squares and rectangles. All marijuana is cannabis, not all cannabis is marijuana. And that's purely based on the federal legal definition. That's not a scientific divide. When the 2018 Farm Bill, which is this bill that passes supposedly every 5 years in the United States, Congress legalized hemp. And when they wrote that bill, they defined hemp as any cannabis product that has less than 0.3% THC by weight. So that's a very confusing thing. But essentially, if you see something that is CBD, that's technically federally legal. However, it's not federally regulated. And that's where things get messy. That's where you see CBD products in airports. So marijuana then is anything that has THC above 0.3% weight. However, you could have a 9-gram edible, and 0.3% of that edible would still be 27 milligrams of THC. Most people who don't consume cannabis will get high on 2 to 4 milligrams of THC. So that makes this very confusing. And technically, that edible would be legal right now in the state of North Carolina. But it's a different thing from when you go to Colorado or Oregon and you walk into a marijuana dispensary and you buy a product that is majority THC and not a lot of CBD. I know that's still it probably is. Confusing, but I hope that explains.
Well, you know what? It's confusing to me. But I think there's some folks listening who say, I got it. I got it. And I've already bought some somewhere else. And I'm just waiting for this dispensary to open and for, and I guess, for the rules to eventually change. You know, we tried to talk with someone with the company that manages the Great Smoky Cannabis Company dispensary, really just to learn about this effort. Because just like you said, it's... I mean, there's nothing like this around. You know, they're one of the first to do this and to go get this far at doing this. And we didn't hear back from them, but we have a bit of audio from to play. It's from a video on their website of, you know, the Great Smoky Cannabis Company below. And the words kind of start, you know, our story begins with tradition and community.
Of course, we being Indian people have always used natural remedies and cures for everything that we have had in the way of sickness and maladies.
To continue that tradition and provide a medicine for not only our enrolled members, but people in the region, and not like a pharmaceutical medicine, is a huge thing.
You know, I just want to, you know, be a part of something that is going to give back to our people, you know, and give back to the world. I mean, this is like a hidden secret right under our nose, you know, of healing properly.
And Lily, you know, maybe you can talk about, you know, the economic opportunities, you know, that are involved with this particular venture. Because if you listen to later, more in the video, one of the people interviewed talks about having been part of the gaming industry and how hard it was during the pandemic to not have a diverse stream of money coming in. So there are high hopes for this dispensary.
Yeah, that's really been a big part of this conversation for the Eastern Band is just what this can mean for the tribe economically. Just like you said, there has been a push to really diversify their economy beyond gaming. The casino has, you know, been really successful, but I think everyone kind of learned in 2020 it's not a great thing to have all your eggs in one basket. They're really hoping that this will be able to benefit the economy. And part of that has been this real vertical integration of this company. So they're growing the marijuana and cannabis on the boundary, just like Natalie was talking about the Farm Bill Act. This started for them with, you know, growing hemp. And so it's really grown from there. And so now they're able to have this all of these folks employed, and they talk a lot at Tribal Council just about how many folks are employed at the dispensary and how many more are going to be employed when they are able to move into adult use and recreational marijuana.
Hmm. Maybe you can tell me just quickly a little history about this effort and really if there's overall member support, you know, how many people are actually involved in this venture, the Eastern Band of Cherokee Indians?
Yeah, so, you know, when we talk about these laws being approved and moving forward with medical marijuana and adult use marijuana, those came from referendum votes for the Eastern Band of Cherokee. So when the adult use vote was passed in September of 2023, that was voted on by the citizens of the Eastern Band, and it passed 2-1. So there is community support for this effort, but there are definitely people who that have trepidation just around, you know, kind of drug use and things like that, just kind of the basic discussions around what this will mean for the community there. And I think that's why Tribal Council is taking so much time to work on the ordinances around adult use. And there was a new chief elected in 2023 at that referendum vote. So there's kind of a new group of tribal council members that have come into power after that vote passed. And so they're really trying to wrap their heads around what this means and get up on this conversation and figure out what they want to do for the tribe. So there have been discussions around making sure that people might not be able to smoke near schools, daycares, things like that. So we'll see what happens.
Well, Natalie, we hear about all this support, but also we know there are people who question this effort, and among them are North Carolina's U.S. Senators Tom Tillis and Ted Budd. Both are Republicans. Are they alone in questioning this? Is this something that's divided down party lines?
You know, there is support amongst both parties for legalization. Even typically half or more of Republicans polled across a number of different polls express support for recreational marijuana. And by far, typically two-thirds or more of voters express support for medical marijuana and Republican voters. And so I would say that, you know, Tillis and Budd are a bit out of the norm in terms of the average American voter, but they're not out of the norm in terms of the average American politician. I think that when you see the states that have legalized, typically their voters legalized marijuana. And, you know, you go back to Colorado, the current senator from Colorado, John Hickenlooper, was the governor in Colorado when Colorado legalized marijuana, and he did not support the ballot initiative, and he's a Democrat. He's since come around and he's a supporter of cannabis legalization on Capitol Hill. But it's very common for lawmakers to be more conservative, small C conservative. They don't want to get blamed if something goes wrong or goes poorly.
Is there support across the South? What about our Southern region?
Yeah, I don't know the specific polling for every state in the South, but I know, you know, take Mississippi recently legalized medical marijuana by a pretty solid vote, and that was a ballot initiative. Florida is going to be heading to the polls with a ballot initiative for recreational marijuana this November that there's some polling that looks like it will pass, and it needs to get 60% in Florida, not just 50%. So there is support in some southern states that I do know of, but the South is the area of the country that had the least states with ballot initiative processes. So there are states, you know, South Carolina has been trying to legalize medical marijuana, but it must go through the state legislature. Same with North Carolina. So that, I think, is one of the reasons why the South still tends to be the place where there is the least amount of medical or recreational marijuana legalized.
Well, thank you both for joining me today. The one thing we do know that's going to happen is tomorrow, North Carolina's first marijuana dispensary will open in Cherokee. Thank you very much, Lily Knepp, Senior Regional Reporter with Blue Ridge Public Radio, and Natalie Furtick, Federal Cannabis Policy Reporter with Politico. Again, thank you.
Thanks, Lena.
Thank you.
Due South is a production of WUNC and a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Our producers are Stacia Brown, Coldell Charco, and Rachel McCarthy. Denarius Thomas is our technical director. Aaron Kiever is our executive producer. Our theme music is by Quilla. Jeff Tiberi is my co-host, and I'm Leonita Inge. For more Due South, go to DueSouthRadio.org.